A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, where it is Sunday evening in London and Solihull, where you find us this evening. We all have Rome on our tellies, and it looks like Solihull, quite frankly, and has done all week. We're at the midway point of the tournament, sort of ish. I think it got going officially on Wednesday. Monday, Tuesday was qualifying, but we're sort of at the midway point. And I have got a match between Alexander Zverev and David Goffin on my screen, and everybody watching is wrapped in blankets. And quite frankly, it's just good to see tennis being played, because a lot of the tournament so far has been, well, where is a Solihull weekend, David? What is going on, and can it please change in the next 18 hours before I arrive in Rome? Because I've seen the forecast and I am most displeased by it.
Yeah, yeah. It hasn't exactly been vintage so far, has it, for the last week? I kind of feel like Rome and Solihull have swapped weathers for the day, because we've actually had quite nice weather today. But at least it didn't rain all day, and it did mean that the catch-up that they had at the tournament really made for a heck of a special day. Matches everywhere. You needed more screens than I own. But I had a right good go at watching as much of it as I could. I do think it's a brilliant tournament. And I actually have to say about this one, this day today has been one of the plus points to the longer tournament, because you wouldn't have had this day on a week-long tournament starting on a Monday. This really was something. You get the feeling that in Rome they come out big time at the weekend, and because a lot of the matches are on outside courts or Pietrangeli, which is an accessible court on a grounds pass, and it's only, I think I saw it was €24 to get in, the atmosphere was electric. It was so special at that tournament today.
Yeah, we'll talk about Pietrangeli over the course of this episode, and I'm sure the next two that we'll be recording midweek and after the tournament ends on Sunday, because it is truly, and we're sort of taken aback by it every year afresh, aren't we? It is truly one of the most special arenas in all of sport, I think, even when it is populated by people wrapped in blankets, which is becoming a sort of iconic European clay court night session sight, isn't it? I really hope this isn't a foreshadowing of the French Open to come. I've seen enough people wrapped in blankets watching clay court tennis.
No, we're saving it up, Catherine. We're saving up the good weather news.
Well, they do say that Rome is the clay court event most like the French Open. And feels like the fans are warming up for Paris as well, because that was a feature at Roland Garros last year, wasn't it? Just hordes and hordes of night session fans in blankets. Mm. You two have been taking Pietrangeli chat to Twitter, I noticed, this morning. It was very sort of, I don't know, Tennis Podcast 2018, 2019 vibes, I felt. Normally we just do that on WhatsApp these days, but
well,
what used to happen in 2018?
I don't know. I just
David
think
tweeted
we used to tweet
David
more.
Tweeted a very sweeping, definitive statement from the general tennis podcast account. So I felt like I needed to clarify from my own account that I... It's not that I specifically disagreed with the statement. I just wanted to make the point that it was a very... It was a subjective take, I think, being treated objectively. Look, this is really boring. I should just... It was the debate about Pietrangeli being, I think, David, you called it the best court in tennis. And I said, look, in the world. And I think it's the most beautiful, or certainly the most something, the most historic, the most artistic, the most aesthetic something. But I think the best... I think everybody will have their own different take on
what the
best is.
I was just, it was just what I was feeling at the moment.
You were provoking debate,
and
David.
It worked.
What you wanted.
I was about to write the word discuss below it, which I normally do, and then I thought, no, I'm not going to, because I genuinely look at this court, and because you questioned it, it made me start thinking, now, do I regard it just as the most beautiful, or do I really regard it as the best? And I started to think, I don't think there is a downside to this court. I think it has got everything. It is sunken into the ground. It is surrounded by statues. You're sitting on, I mean, maybe it's not the comfiest, you know, you're sitting
roof.
On those marble.
Yeah,
okay, it hasn't got, but it's... You know, it soaks up the weather, it seems to me. They seem to play through anything on that court. And the fact is, people are wandering in on grounds passes on €24 tickets. It was 11 a.m. on a Sunday, and there wasn't a spare seat for Maria Sakkari against Markéta Vondrousova. It felt like the biggest deal in the world, that match, because of the atmosphere created. And I just don't... And they're so close to it, and they're enjoying every single bit of it. It's perfection.
Yeah, look, don't get me wrong. I love that court. I'm not... I'm playing devil's advocate to an extent. And it
you're
doesn't...
Right to, you're right to do that, though. You were right to, because my wording wasn't quite right.
It doesn't have a shadow problem, which increasingly feels anomalous in tennis, doesn't it? Because... Mm. We do spend quite a lot of our lives whinging about shadows on our WhatsApp group, don't we? And I think with good cause. We will start talking about more interesting things. But Matt, would you like to take the reins for a quick rant about shadows?
Sure.
Or would you like to save it for my proposed worst shadows in tennis podcast for a slow week, which is still in the brainstorm page?
Would you like to take a Pietrangeli view?
Oh gosh, I think I'm going to go with the shadows.
Decider.
I mean, I think the shadows are particularly bad during the clay court swing, and actually during this back-to-back double, Madrid is terrible for shadows, really bad.
Why is Rome so bad? Because I think of courts with roofs as the worst shadow offenders. You know, Philippe Chatrier, the shadow got a lot worse after it was retrofitted with a roof, didn't it? I don't quite understand why Rome is so bad. I mean, obviously the answer to that is, you know, physics. so we won't delve too deep there. But to not have a roof and have bad shadows, and it piss with rain all week, just feels like, you know.
You got me with the roof. It's not perfection because it doesn't have a roof. That's fair.
Yeah, but then I know that something would be taken away from it if it did have a roof, yada, yada, yada. Anyway, look, this episode of the Tennis Podcast is brought to you in association with On Location. I'm using On Location as a handy breakwater here between chat subjects. Do you see what I'm doing? On Location are the premium hospitality and experience provider. They provide packages via Steve Fergal's international tennis stores to all of the four Grand Slam tournaments, including the US Open, which is on sale now with fantastic tickets to watch the action throughout the year's final Grand Slam at Flushing Meadows in New York, and hospitality packages to help you kick back and relax with all-inclusive food and drinks in a lounge and rooftop bar in between matches. We have a 5% discount for Tennis Podcast listeners. Just go to toursfortennis.com/podcast, toursfortennis.com/podcast, click the US Open discount section and enter the code Final Slam, all in caps, FINALSLAM, for your 5% discount off your ticket and hospitality package. Brace yourselves, folks. The disclaimer is a-coming. The coupon code FINALSLAM works when you purchase eligible 2023 US Open ticket and hospitality packages until May 31st, 2023 at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. You can only use the code once and it cannot be used with other discounts or on previous purchases. You'll see your savings when you add an eligible package to your cart and use the code at checkout. This offer does not apply to hotel packages or other events from Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours or on location and its subsidiaries. If you have any questions pertaining to this offer, not just generally, email info@toursfortennis.com. See onlocationexp.com's purchase policy for more information. I don't know what more information you could possibly need, but it is there should you want it. Now, before we get on to discuss what has happened so far in Rome, which we will, I promise you that, let's pick up where we left off last week, which was the fallout from the women's doubles final ceremony in Madrid, where the four finalists, including the champions Victoria Azarenka and Beatriz Haddad Maia, were denied the opportunity to speak in the presentation ceremony, and they'd taken to Twitter to express their unsettlement and anger at this, and other notable players had chimed in as well. At the point of recording last week, the tournament had been silent on the matter. Of course, all of those players, Coco Gauff, Jessica Pegula, the runners-up as well, they all then trooped off to Rome, where they did, a lot of them did pre-tournament press, and as you would expect, were asked about what happened. And Jessica Pegula did not hold back. She said the following: "I don't know what century everyone was living in when they made that decision, or how they had a conversation and decided, wow, this is a great decision and there's going to be no backlash against this. I've never heard in my life we wouldn't be able to speak. It was really disappointing. In a $10,000 event final, you would speak. It spoke for itself. We were upset when it happened and told during the trophy ceremony we weren't able to speak. It kind of proved a point. We made some inquiries behind the scenes and it became apparent to us that the WTA were not happy with what transpired in Madrid. And it also became very clear that IMG, who owned the Madrid event, realised that what happened was unacceptable. And then sure enough, a statement from the Mutua Madrid Open was forthcoming, but not until 4 days had passed after the ceremony, which had been last Sunday. The statement read thus: "We sincerely apologise to all the players and fans who expect more of the Mutua Madrid Open tournament. Not giving our women's doubles finalists the chance to address their fans at the end of the match was unacceptable, and we have apologised directly to Victoria, Beatriz, Coco and Jessica. We are working internally and with the WTA to review our protocols and are committed to improving our process moving forward. We made a mistake and this will not ever happen again." What is everyone's reaction to those addenda to the whole sorry tale in Madrid?
I would say that IMG probably started to realise that this wasn't going away. It was escalating, it was snowballing, it was moving like wildfire on social media with people shocked, really. I think when people did discover it, maybe that didn't know it, they just cannot believe that this is happening at a tennis tournament. I think Jessica Pegula in particular handled herself brilliantly when she spoke, and even when you were reading that out, Catherine, I find myself shaking my head. I still can't quite believe that happened. And what we lack in that statement from the tournament is any explanation as to why it happened. And, you know, yes, they've said it's unacceptable. But, okay, how did you get to that point? How did you get to thinking that that was the right thing to do in the first place? Yeah, you're looking at your protocols, but come on. It's just, it's unbelievable to me that happened. Of all the things that went on in Madrid, and there was a lot, and there's years and years of it, that is the worst. That is the, to me, that is the one that, it just really upsets me thinking about it. And I'm happy that they got dragged over the coals over it, and I'm happy that they have now given an unequivocal apology for it. But there's still a lot to be done here, I think, to actually now prove that changes are going to be made.
Yeah, there was a fantastic piece by Matt Futterman in the New York Times, wasn't there, midweek, which I do wonder whether that was sort of the tipping point for this statement to come out. Who knows? It might well have been in the works before that. Certainly the conversations were, but a really fantastic piece that drew a lot of traction and just highlighted how we need to not be treating this as an isolated incident. This is part of a culture in tennis of treating the women as second-class citizens. We have equal prize money at a select few events. That was hard fought and is still questioned by a lot of very powerful corners of this sport. That is one thing that is great, and I'm very grateful for it, but it does not mean that women receive equal treatment anywhere on the tour. I mean, just to highlight what's going on in Rome this week, the total prize money pool for the ATP there is $7,705,780, which is up 42.29% on last year. And the total prize money pool for the WTA in Rome is €3,572,618, up 41.36% on last year. The women's champion will pick up just under half of what the men's winner receives, with €521,754 for the women's champ and €1,105,265 for the men's. And the men's runner-up will earn more than the women's winner. The prize money in Madrid was equal. However, John Millman on Twitter drew your attention, David, to something that we've had on the agenda to talk about for a while, haven't we, which is this profit-sharing model for the premium product of longer Masters events. Help me out here, David, because I'm looking through the agenda and there's some algorithms in there, which is, yeah, which it's not my preferred territory.
Yeah, it's interesting, and John was, you know, I should also say he was one of the people that really put it to Madrid over this apology that they put out, and he said, you know, just treat people decently, and then you won't have this problem. And I think that really summed it up very well. But he did make the point to me when I was kind of at the start of the tournament, I was celebrating the fact that Madrid has equal prize money, and I kind of feel as though I don't want to always be complaining about ones that don't. I also want to point out the ones that do, and reference that's good, because it's an ongoing conversation. But he said, yes, it is equal prize money, but there is a profit sharing element that ATP players are getting, and as part of this deal, and basically it's distributed as a sort of value per ranking point accumulated in the Masters 1000 events by the players. And what they do is they work out the total profit share generally is divided by the points that across the Masters 1000 to come up with a sort of value per point. based on how much money each one of these masters makes as a combination. And then the players get given this amount of money. So I then wanted to know from the WTA, well, do you have a profit-sharing agreement? So I asked, and they don't. So it isn't actually equal prize. I mean, it's equal prize money, but it's not actual equal money. Now, some people might say, well, yeah, okay, well, that's WTA's problem for not doing the deal with the Masters 1000 tournaments. But I mean, and it is, but it's also, you know, I think that needs to be publicised a bit more so that people know that these tournaments are still not paying these players equally because they're paying the men a share of their profits and they're not doing that with the women. There's also the bonus pool, which is given by the ATP to the top 30 players now. It's increased from the top 12. And so the top 30 players at the end of the year get a share each of $20 million. That's a lot of money. That's up from $11 million. So well done, ATP. You know, you've raised this money and the players will be happier and all this sort of thing. Again, I asked the WTA, have you got one of these? No, they haven't. Now, obviously, that's about how much money they've got. And there is a difference there in terms of how much money they've made. And they've had the whole China thing and everything else. But, and whilst I accept all those arguments that people make, the point is that it would be better if the two sports were combined, the two governing bodies were combined. They're playing a combined event in Rome. They're getting less than half the prize money. They're playing a combined event in Madrid. They're getting equal prize money. Yet there's this profit share agreement just for the men. I mean, it's just not ideal, is it? So let's try to do something about it, is my view on it. And I'm actually grateful to John for alerting me to that.
Yeah. Yeah, ultimately, look, we understand all the reasons that, or most of the reasons that all of these things are the way they are. But our response to all of that is, okay, but let's make it right. Let's all work to make it right rather than trying to defend the reasons that it's wrong, because it is wrong at the moment. We're a long way from true equality, and that is not right. I'm going to quote you back to yourself, Matt. On the WhatsApp group earlier, you said, I do love the European clay swing, but the sexism in the shadows make it hard.
Bringing it back to the shadows. No, well, it's true, though, isn't it? I mean, every year we have these conversations. And I think what Matt Futterman's piece did so well, I thought, was point out the perhaps more subtle ways that women are not treated equally in tennis. And I do think that actually the Madrid women's doubles ceremony might be a significant moment, because as David said, I was surprised, but in a good way, by how much coverage that got. You know, that was real front and center on the BBC Sport website. Other big news outlets as well were really covering that. And I think it resonated with people, but generally the inequality is more subtle than that. And I think Matt's piece did a really good job of laying that out, and also made the point that, you know, there are some events like Indian Wells, for example, and I know that that's funded by a billionaire, but that has made equality a priority. Whereas there are some events like Rome, which simply haven't. And it's pointed out in the piece that equal prize money is aiming to come in there by 2025. But there's also Paolo Bellossa quoted in that piece saying, well, why isn't it equal now? Why are we having to wait a few years? Why is it good news that it's just coming in 2 years? Why is it not happening now? And a spokesperson from the event, from the Italian Federation, wasn't made available for Matt to speak to. So I really do think Matt's piece is significant there. I think we should, you know, I'm sure we'll put a link to it in our show notes for anyone who hasn't read it. But it really does lay out this issue and explain some of the errors that the WTA has made as well, you know, and yet some of those errors feels like the tournaments are hiding behind. For example, Matt's piece points to the fact that Rome or isn't mandatory for the WTA of players, whereas it is for the ATP, and the tournament uses that as a way to say, well, we can't guarantee that the top players are going to be there, so therefore we can't put so much money into that event. Well, everyone knows that in reality, all the top players are in Rome, unless they're injured or can't be. You know, the fields are equal for those two events. So, yeah, props to Matt for writing that piece and sort of summarising it so well. And, yeah, I despair at this time of year, hence the WhatsApp message.
Yeah, absolutely. Props to Matt. Highly recommend a read of that article if you have time. And we will put a link to it in our show notes. On to the tennis in Rome. Zverev is just one. I've switched over to Donna Vekic, who is 3-2 up with a break against the utterly inexplicable Ludmila Samsonova, who has some next level strapping on all of her limbs, and is somehow competitive in this match. I mean, she's right there in the Vondroušová, I don't understand you category of tennis player. But anyway, won't get bogged down in Vekic-Samsonova because that'll be very much soon to be out of date tennis news. The most significant result, I think, that we've seen so far in Rome is the loss of Aryna Sabalenka in her opening match to Sofia Kenin, Australian Open champion and French Open finalist, of course. That's the achievement of Kenin's that I so often forget. And it was a very deserved victory by Sofia Kenin. Very deserved indeed. Sabalenka posted on all of her social medias afterwards about her fatigue, didn't she? You know, made it very clear that she just didn't have the gas in the tank to compete, I don't think. That was my take out there. You know, Kenin was doing that head bobbing bit between the teeth thing. She looked really dialed in and focused and saw an opportunity there. You know, it's pretty clear early doors that Sabalenka was on fumes. And I do think more mentally, emotionally than physically. I suspect, you know, if that had been the French Open, she'd have found something, she'd have found a reserve, but she just didn't have it in her to go into the trenches. And it was a little bit Sabalenka of old, I suppose, just a lot of unforced errors. And it was Kenin of old as well, out of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, from a Sabalenka perspective, I agree. It looked and seemed a lot like mental fatigue. As you said, she tweeted about needing to recharge the batteries. And it did get me thinking again about these 12-day Masters events back to back. I think, you know, for the women especially who play best of three at the Slams as well, there's not that much difference now in terms of the amount of tennis in the amount of time that you have to play it. You know, it's six matches, best of three. Over for the top seeds, it's 10, 11 days or so. And Catherine, you did the Sunshine Double this year. You know, you stayed on right through from the start of Indian Wells to the end of Miami. And, you know, it's grueling. And I think it's grueling for these players going deep. And I think we were surprised by how many players did go deep in Miami and Indian Wells. But I probably shouldn't ever be surprised that some players, there's going to be a drop-off after a really big event like that. And Sabalenka, it was a big deal for her winning Madrid. That took a lot of her, took a lot from her. Also just coming off the back of Stuttgart as well. And I think, you know, okay, Iga Świątek seems fine in Rome, but maybe Aryna Sabalenka just didn't quite have it in her and just was a little bit short that day, and Kenin really, really pounced on it. And there have been little signs from Kenin this year. Semis in Hobart, I think. She played Rybakina tough at Indian Wells, but this was as you said, kind of out of nowhere and really did take me back. But credit to her for taking advantage of Sabalenka, who I think was a little bit there for the taking, I suppose.
I think nobody should have to do back-to-back 1,000 events without getting to go to a Taylor Swift concert between them. New rule.
Just on Sabalenka, I do wonder. I didn't see this match. You guys were telling me all about it. I was away at the time, but it did occur to me. Maybe she's hiding a little bit behind that fatigue, which would be very understandable to be fatigued and to be affected. But she's got it all to prove that she's actually any good on this sort of clay court. And in Paris as well. I mean, she's been beaten badly on these courts in the past, and she's been beaten again here. So, you know, I'm the one who said I thought she wouldn't be. I said I think she will have a great run at one of these tournaments. Well, one of them she's lost in the first round, so there's only one to go. But yeah, it might be an element of excuse making there.
I definitely don't think it's ideal at all. I was surprised at how kind of resigned to it she seemed, and accepting of it. You know, the nature of that social media post suggested to me that she might have gone on the court in Rome thinking, I'll give this a go, but I don't think it's there for me. You know, she did not seem at all shocked or surprised by that defeat, which does surprise me a little bit. But yeah, you're right, David. Never passed the third round in Roland Garros. Never been great shakes in Rome. Yeah, it's not ideal for her French Open preparation, for sure. I think understatement of the podcast award goes to Matt for saying Świątek is, what did he say, fine in Rome? Good?
Doing all right, maybe I said.
Doing all right in Rome. She's doing all right, Matt.
Yeah, well, she was 2 love down today against Serenko, and such is Iga Świątek's level of dominance and my high expectations of her, that felt like a, oh my God, I need to get Iga Świątek match on. What is happening? She's lost 2 games in a row. And of course, I did put it on, and she then won 12 games in a row, just as she did in her opening match in Rome against former French Open finalist Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova. So 6-love, 6-love, 6-2, 6-love are her 4 sets in Rome. So yeah, doing all right.
There was a nice moment at the net with Serenko, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was really something, actually, because, I mean, bear in mind, Serenko has just lost 2 in love. But she's a Ukrainian player wearing one of the little Ukrainian flag ribbons on her shirt. And she really wanted to catch Świątek's eye and say, I really appreciate what you've been doing, saying, and illustrating with the ribbon on your hat for the last year and a half, to show solidarity, to show support to Ukraine and Ukrainian tennis players. And it was really, really great to see Serenko just put that way ahead of any tennis match. You know, this was her opportunity at the net to say a few words, and she did. And it was great to see.
Jessica Pegula lost to Taylor Townsend, who I'm just rooting for so hard to put something together in singles. She's been going great guns in doubles, playing with Leila Fernandez, finalists in Miami and then semi-finalists in Madrid as well. And I suspect she's using that as a platform for her singles. I mean, this is, you know, these are early green shoots, but we know how good she can be. I think about that match she played against Simona Halep at the US Open a few years ago quite a lot. Like, you had a moment today, Matt, where you remembered that David Goffin once beat Thomas Burdick love and love in Rome. You know, when just a match pops into your mind, that Taylor Townsend against Simona Halep match pops into my mind quite a lot. The most swashbuckling tennis match anybody's ever played, really, I suppose, relative to expectations. And I don't know what this means. I don't know what it means for Pegula, who hasn't had a great clay court season, I suppose, relative to last year. Fine in Rome. This is a not great result. In Madrid, rather. It's an interesting one with Pegula. I found her quotes after, I think, her second win in Madrid really interesting, where she said she's so proud of herself for putting together wins against players on clay that really not that long ago she would have kind of defeated herself against. You know, she'd have driven herself mad. She wouldn't have believed. I don't know. She's, after picking her to win the Australian Open so confidently, I don't know what to do with her now. What do we do with Jessica Pegula, Matt?
I would say she's still not having many bad losses. Like, I think the Townsend one is stood out to me because she's just been so reliably beating those sorts of players for like the last year. Like, I think you have to go back kind of to Wimbledon or just after Wimbledon last year, where I think she lost to Petra Martic and she lost to Daria Saville back to back. Honestly, for losses where you think Pegula should have won that. I think a lot of her other losses have been against, you know, other top 10, top 15 players. And even those ones last year, I kind of give Pegula a pass because everything was going on with her mum back then, and that is still a part of her life as well. And I think generally she's still fine. I do stand by kind of how I felt in Australia, where some players feel like they have a moment that they need to capitalize on, and Pegula was playing so well, and Świątek wasn't playing all that well, and Świątek had been Pegula's problem. It felt like that was such a big chance for her. But in the end, you know, Sabalenka's stepped up and Rybakina's stepped up, and maybe Pegula hasn't done all that differently. It's just maybe other players have stepped up and sort of become the real contenders to challenge Świątek now rather than Pegula. Those two
have got a gear she doesn't
have. That's it. I would say they've got bigger ultimately games. Pegula is absolutely made the most of her game and more. And I think the clay court swing is not going to be her favorite time of year. I know she did well in Madrid last year. That's always a bit of an anomaly. I think if she can make the second week in Paris, that would be a pretty good French Open for her. And then, you know, she gets on the grass and the American hard court swing, and I think things could be good for Pegula again. She'll be right there, I expect.
When you were talking about that match being beaten by Townsend, God, I would love to see Townsend have a run on grass.
Or, I mean, anywhere, but yeah, on grass, that'd but, you know, be...
She should be perfect for grass, shouldn't she?
She's fantastic. I've got Vondroušová is happening? ? On my agenda, and I would like whoever wrote that to explain themselves.
I'm with you, Matt. I'm with you.
Look, I'm not disagreeing. I'm just electing never to express any kind of prediction or opinion about Markéta Vondroušová ever, because that way madness lies.
Oh, I'm right there with you. But she is so good in these conditions, I think, especially. And going back to her run to the French Open final, what was that, 2019? That was a cold, damp, slow French Open. You know, that was why she had to play her semi-final on Simone Mathieu, because there were so many rain delays. And seeing her today when it was, and the other day in Rome, when it's been those heavy conditions, she has taken apart Bianca Andreescu for the loss of just one game here, and then Maria Sakkari in straight sets, who she'd never even won a set against. And She picked Andreescu apart. Andreescu didn't play well, but Vondroušová was awesome. Her sort of down-the-line shots were brilliant. She's got such good hands. And then watching her today against Sakkari, you just realised they're completely opposite players. You know, if they could have each other's strengths, you would sort of form a kind of super player, I think, because Vondroušová has none of Sakkari's intensity or consistency. You know, Sakkari is always week in, week out. We know what Sakkari is. She's completely explicable as a tennis player, whereas Vondroušová is the opposite, inexplicable, and yet has these great hands, has this vision on the court. The way she sees the court is just so magnificent, and she's able to always be sort of one step ahead, I think, on clay, especially in these conditions. And I really, really want to see her play Iga Świątek at this tournament. They're in the same section. I think Vondroušová might have to go through Rybakina first.
That's right.
But it's a really interesting section of the draw.
I think she, if she's got her head screwed on for that match, I think she'll beat Rybakina. I personally think Vondroušová, I was just looking up, she's 70 in the world. Her highest ranking ever was 14. To me, if everybody's playing to the peak of their ability, she's comfortably a top 10 player. And actually, I'd say she's a top 5 player. I think she's brilliant in terms of just her ability. But there's a lot more to it than
that. Yeah. I think her serve is a weakness. It's very much a get the point started serve. And today she got away with it against Sakkari. I could see Rybakina sort of stepping in and causing that some problems. But once the point gets going, especially on a clay court, she can outmaneuver anyone. It's fantastic to watch. Is she happening? I've probably felt this way several times over the last 4 years or so probably not. But I, as David said, would love to see it because she's a joy to watch.
There are tentative signs, aren't there, that Paula Badosa might be happening again just a little bit or might possibly happen again in the future. Who's she beaten this week? She has beaten
Marta Kostyuk and Ons Jabeur.
And Annalena Friedsam, yeah, 7-6 in the third, that Friedsam match wasn't it? She will now face Karolina Mukova in a match scheduled for tomorrow. I don't want to get carried away because I thought there were really good signs in Rome when she beat Coco Gauff. And then as we discussed on the podcast, I was a bit disappointed in her performance against Maria Sakkari in the round of 16. So, like, I think it is going to be two steps forward, one step back for Badosa. It's obviously not going to be the sort of comeback where she, you know, just suddenly wins something out of nowhere. It's obviously a building block situation. But I do just wonder if she's building a bit of a foundation now, just building a bit of a well of confidence that she can draw on in the tighter matches, because we know how good the tennis is. And I'm so ready to see it. I've been particularly surprised this year that having had the terrible year that she had last year, and, you know, we know a lot of the reasons for that. She's been very open about her struggles with mental health, and I believe there'll be even more of that on the second part of the Netflix series. And interestingly, I believe Netflix are following her again this year, despite her obviously results wise being a bit of a dud for them last year. They obviously found her story very compelling, I find that an interesting editorial decision from them to continue following her. I'm caught here because I don't want to fall into the trap that I did in Madrid last week, where I was like, oh, Badosa's back, guys. because it's obviously not going to be as linear as that, but she might be coming back. I mean, that's a good win over Jabeur. Straight sets.
Yeah, but Jabeur is also coming back. I think it is a good win, but she's not there yet. I just feel like there are shoots. I agree with you. There are shoots of recovery, but she's got to she's got to be tested against the better players, and a few times. I'm not convinced yet.
Okay, well, that's that then. On to the men.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Early days here, but Djokovic and Alcaraz still remain on course to actually play one another in a tennis match. Big.
Excellent.
Guys, it's big.
This time next week it might have just happened.
Djokovic has just a couple of hours ago beaten Grigor Dimitrov in three sets. David and his relentless, irrepressible hope for Grigor Dimitrov is one of my... It's one of my favourite things about David Law, and not just that it exists, the fact that he's willing to state it so publicly to us. Every time Grigor Dimitrov plays one of these matches that you deep down feel like he's definitely not going to win, David will send a message to the group saying, just got a feeling Dimitrov could cause some problems today. And I suppose he did, David, cause Djokovic one or two problems?
Yeah, Dimitrov and predictions and golf have a lot in common in my life, because all of them, no matter how many times they show themselves to be a lost cause, I only need the merest flicker of good news to believe that it's all going to turn around. And everything's going to be just amazing. And actually, in this match, look, he was 4-1 down. Djokovic is a nightmare for him. I mean, he's a nightmare for a lot of people, but particularly Dimitrov. I mean, Djokovic used to have his way against Roger Federer more often than not, particularly in the last sort of 7 or 8 years. And Dimitrov is a much worse version of Roger Federer, isn't he? With a single-handed backhand and a serve that's not as good and so forth. And I mean, it's absolutely dominant, the head-to-head for Djokovic. And you can see why when they play each other. So it was really interesting when Djokovic was a set and a break up that it then turned, because and it was on both sides of the net. Dimitrov played some brilliant attacking tennis and took it to him, and Jamie Delgado, who's coaching him these days, was audible and heard to be saying go for the forehand, but it wasn't just that. It was he sensed that Djokovic's irritation at his lack of control with his footwork on those courts. He was not enjoying the service, the particular clay, after all the rain and everything else, he didn't feel like he had a proper footing. And Dimitrov was extending rallies, using his slice backhand, just to make sure he kept peppering the baseline and the footholds and all the rest of the imperfections in that area of the court to just irritate Djokovic some more. And he came back from 4-2 down to win the second set 7-5. It was a very, very good comeback. But then classic Djokovic dusts himself down, and I suppose you might say a classic Dimitrov, couldn't carry it on. And the third set was 6-1. Djokovic is so good at regrouping in those situations, even when it's not best of five now. I mean, it's a good win for him today, I think.
And just to compare the Djokovic we've seen in Rome to the Djokovic we've seen on clay so far this season, I would say it's been quite a lot better. I think I've been looking at Rome as the moment, okay, is this when Novak Djokovic clicks into gear on the clay? And I would say it hasn't quite happened yet. He did have some problems against Thomas Martin Echeverry in the first round. He actually was practicing pre-tournament without the sleeve on his elbow. And I thought, well, that's a really good sign. And he comes out onto court against Echeverry without the sleeve, gets broken in the very first game of the match and puts it on. And I thought, oh, okay, here we go. Maybe there is still an issue here. He said after the match it was mainly to warm the elbow up because he was playing late at night. It was cold. That can cause some problems for that elbow. He played today against Dimitrov without it. So I think his elbow seems to have improved. There was a graphic that came up on the coverage I was watching saying that his forehand speed was up 8 or 9 kilometers per hour compared to Monte Carlo earlier in the season. So I think there are some good signs for Djokovic. He's got a really tough draw if he wants to make it, you know, to win the event. He might have to go through Rune, Sinner and Alcaraz. That would really test him. But, you know,
And Norrie, absolutely.
I've done the classic writing off Cameron Norrie thing. I apologize. but yeah, I think he's had some adversity. He was sick on the court in his first round match. He completely threw away the second set today, as David's described. So all's not quite right. And yet Djokovic in Rome, he's so good there. And I feel like he's starting to get the good feelings again on the clay. He's quite a compelling watch at the moment.
Maybe the sleeve has become a comfort blanket for him, like it did with Milos Raonic. Do you remember those times when he started wearing the sleeve for, you know, injury-based reasons, and then it became a sort of crutch for him? And then Tennis Canada on Twitter started trying to make hashtag believe in the sleeve happen. Remember that?
Yep.
Yes. What a time. What a time to be alive.
I had a rumour that Milos Raonic might be coming back today. But
look, we are running out of time, David. And we don't have the time for me to process my thoughts about Milos Raonic being a part of our lives again. Alcaraz beat Albert Ramos Vinolas in his opener very comfortably. Which I suppose is a bit of a sort of benchmark for him, because of course it was Ramos Vinolas that challenged him so much, took him to 5 sets, I think took him to match point at the French Open last year. So very comfortable victory for Alcaraz. He now plays somebody that I have never heard of, Fabian Marozsán of Hungary. So Fabian, I'm sure, is great. I'm backing Alcaraz in that one. Elsewhere in the men's, Fabio Fognini beats Andy Murray in a very throwback opening match, and then got thrashed earlier on today by Holger Rune in a match where Rune was booed onto court. Onto court, guys.
He was smiling. And God, he's a good player, Rune. I mean, aside from the obvious basic talent, he's just such a clever player. He knows what to do to discomfort opponents. I mean, in the first match of his, he played Artifice, of whom we're so excited. I mean, particularly I'm seeking out every time Feast plays at the moment, and he was hitting the ball big and so quick. But Runa is just clever, and he just dissects players. He turns their power back on them, and he looks really good. It reminded me of when Runa destroyed Alexander Zverev in Munich last year. It was a real eye-opening moment for me about him. And then we saw, I think, didn't he beat Tsitsipas at the French Open as well, Runa? I know he's, obviously his win in Paris indoors tells you everything, but on clay, you get to see his full game and he's got time to show it to you. And, God, he's really looking like a danger to big names. I think he's right there behind the top couple.
Yeah, I'm so signed up for Runa Djokovic quarterfinal in Rome. I mean, obviously it won't happen because the forecast for next week is an apocalypse. But hoping, you know, at some point we get to see that.
And also Cameron Norrie. Don't forget, Cameron Norrie might also stop that happening.
Twice
I know,
in 5 minutes.
I know irony when I hear it, Matt.
The best thing I can say about Runa is that he made that match with Fognini kind of boring, because I was ready for drama. As you said, he's literally booed onto court. I sort of felt really sorry for the umpire having to be in charge of that one. I just imagine him like the sort of Ben Affleck meme where he's smoking and the sort of the abject misery of life all across his face when he realised he got that court assignment, because that must just be an absolute nightmare. And Fognini tried his best to make it a nightmare for him, arguing over a line call. But Runa seemed to embrace being booed onto court, and actually, I think, kind of went out there with a real, okay, then I'll just show you what's what with my tennis. And barring a little mini comeback from Fognini in that first set, Runa was just several classes above, really. And He's such a good player, as David's described.
Yeah, I really rate Runa. He picks the right shot. He always picks the right shot. His tennis IQ is so high, and I love to watch players like that. I really want Runa Djokovic to happen. Happy for Norrie Runa to happen also. And Norrie versus whoever Runa is playing in the next round. Don't know who that is. Anyway, all tennis is good tennis.
It's a sensation that Runa has next.
Is it Popperin?
It is.
Didn't Popperin beat Felix Auger-Aliassime? Briefly, we don't have much time here. It's not going well for Felix, is it?
No.
Succinct.
You
appreciate
told me to
it,
be
Matt.
Brief.
Not going well.
Matt says no. It really is no.
Well, look, he had an injury, didn't he? And he's not come off well after that injury. He's lost, I think, his opening match in both Madrid and Rome. He might play again before Roland Garros. That wouldn't surprise me if he takes a late entry into somewhere just to try and get some wins.
Dan Evans lost a match that lasted nearly 4 hours, the longest three-set match of the year so far, against Roberto Carballos Baena. I tuned in for the latter stages of this once it had just become the longest three-set match of the year, and I saw somebody, quite possibly David, tweet about it. So I put it on, and it's just, I don't know why I tortured myself by putting it on, because at that point, you're just going to watch somebody lose after playing for 4 hours, which is just desperate. And that somebody was Dan Evans. So thoughts and prayers with Dan Evans at this difficult time.
I did dial a Dan, Catherine, briefly. And he just said, this sport, man.
There it is. Yep.
Isn't that what Tanasi Kokkinakis tweeted after his match against Andy Murray at the Australian Open this year?
That's
very
correct.
Good, Matt. Mm. Very good. Do we think Dan Evans knew he was quoting Tanasi Kokkinakis?
I'm fairly sure he would be capable of coming up with it as an original.
So one to ponder. I'm going to rollick through a few bits and bobs of other news, and some of it we will come back to in future episodes because they deserve more time and attention. But for now, I'm just going to rollick through due to time constraints. We had the news this week that Amanda Anisimova is taking an indefinite break from the sport. This one is, I mean, it's obviously really sad to see. I feel so torn when I see announcements like this because I think, wow, it's really sad that you have found life on tour so desperately difficult recently. But I also feel so pleased that they've had the courage and the strength to make what must be an unbelievably hard decision to step away for however long that must be. You know, the pressure that you're under to just stay on the hamster wheel, keep your sponsors happy, you know, keep you're a small business, aren't you? You're employing goodness knows how many people. Even if you're miserable and you know it's bad for you, there are significant pressures to just stay out there and put yourself through it. So I really applaud her for making this decision. And look, she's not the only player to have made this decision. It's, I feel like, you know, without any data on it, this is becoming more common. Players, particularly female players, needing to take some time away from the game. I feel like there's probably something that needs to be analysed there and discussed and looked at more closely. Now is not the moment for that, but please know that that is on our radar, as is the fact that we've had the announcement that electronic line calling will be adopted across the ATP Tour, the whole ATP Tour, from 2025. Final testing is being done on clay at the moment. No word on whether that applies to the WTA Tour. No plans that we're aware of at the moment. So look, that's something that we will end up discussing at some point, I am sure. We've had the news this week that the Billie Jean King Cup finals this year will be going to Seville in Spain, which sounds very fun. They do great oranges. Lovely. And I'm sorry to end on such a sad note, but we've also had the news just a couple of days ago that Owen Davidson has passed away. Somebody that was a big part of Billie Jean King's life and career. She tweeted that he was a Hall of Fame tennis champion who proudly represented Australia in Davis Cup, a man who was my mixed doubles partner and a longtime friend to Alana and me. Owen was the only man with whom I could win the mixed at Wimbledon. Together, we won 8 major mixed titles. Our hearts are broken, but we find peace in the lifetime of wonderful memories we shared with our friend Davo. Really moving tribute there. We also had Joel Drucker on the International Hall of Fame website writing that Davidson was the most accomplished mixed doubles player in tennis history. In 1967, he won all 4 major mixed doubles titles, the first with Leslie Turner, then poor old Leslie got binned off and he won the next 3 with Billie Jean King. Look, we all know that when Billie Jean King comes a calling, you don't say no.
Yeah, I'd say yes.
Exactly. In 1968, he played in the first ever match of the Open era, beating John Clifton in the first round of the Bournemouth Hard Court Championships. That's one of those nuggets of tennis information that I'm really going to try and retain because I feel like one day I'll be able to impress somebody in an extremely niche pub quiz with that fact. So our thoughts are with the friends and family of Owen Davidson, who obviously left a huge impact on lots of people and on the sport of tennis. And that is it for the tennis podcast for this week. I'll just remind you that a new episode of Tennis Relived went up on Friday for Friends of the Tennis Podcast. It is our Nick Bollettieri episode contributions from Jimmy Arias, Jim Courier, Mary Carrillo. Really fantastic contributions and some fantastic colour about the life of a man that is so deeply ingrained in the sport of tennis for the last 40 years and who we lost. So do become a friend of the Tennis Podcast if you'd like to be able to listen to that and our whole back catalogue. The link to do so is in our show notes, and you can sign up to the newsletter to be the first to find out about our plans for Roland Garros Relived, which we are trailing hard and teasing hard, but not quite announcing the content of just yet. And finally, but by no means least, that's a mixed saying, isn't it? But I think you get what I mean. Our episode mascot for today is Bianca, owned by Michael Clary. Bianca is a four-month-old black and tan coonhound. She was born at Wyeast Kennels, just outside of Portland, Oregon. She flew to her new home of Calgary on October 21st, 2022. She is a happy puppy, says Michael. Bianca is my first experience of a coonhound. I like to think there aren't many dog breeds. I don't know, but a coonhound is new to me. She's absolutely gorgeous. I'm trying to get a sense of scale in this photo. My feeling is that at 4 months old, if she's this size, she's going to be a big one. but she's absolutely beautiful. Quite spaniely, I would say.
Named after Bianca Andreescu, do we think?
Well, let's assume yes, unless Michael tells us otherwise.
Good choice.
So that is lovely. Bianca, we'll have a picture of her in our newsletter. If you haven't subscribed to the newsletter, what are you playing at? Get on board that train immediately. We have our mascots. David has Maisie. I've got Xenia. Matt has Darwin. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Hannah, Jamie and Drew. And we have shout outs, Matt.
We have Claire Evans in Leeds.
All right, Claire.
Hello, Claire. Like Dan Evans.
Hey.
I hope you've had a better week than Dan, Claire.
And like Claire Liu, a tennis player from America.
Very good, David. Thank you, Claire.
Claire says, Catherine might be interested to know that I also went to Nottingham Uni and was a games maker at the London 2012 Olympics.
Oh, I wish I could go back in time and be a games maker. Very envious, Claire. Well done, you.
We've also got Caroline Alcock in South Buckinghamshire.
Right, Caroline.
Hello, Caroline. Like Caroline Garcia or Caroline Garcia.
Yes.
Wozniacki.
Dolehide.
Wozniacki and Dolehide. all good Carolines.
And finally...
I was going to come up with another Caroline, but I feel like we've covered off Carolines. Thank you, Caroline.
Cheers, Caroline.
And finally, we've got Josh, who we met in Indian Wells. We met Josh and his family, and Josh's mum, Wendy, has been in touch to say that Josh is graduating from med school in New York this week. So hey. He will soon be Dr. Josh. So a wow. Shout out and a congratulations to Josh from us.
Good
that
work,
is
Josh.
So cool. Wow.
Amazing.
Congratulations, Josh. That is a heck of an effort. I remember meeting Josh and family. We loved it when families came to the booth in Indian Wells, didn't we? Yeah. Very, very wholesome, heartwarming stuff. So
and we were chuffed to hear from Wendy the other day. That was lovely.
It was always fun trying to spot who the main listener was. And with Josh, it was very obvious.
Yeah, It was, and we love you for that. Thank you, Josh, and congratulations. That is it for this week's first tennis podcast, but we'll have another one coming at you midweek, covering off all the events in Rome, and then we'll have another one at the end of the tournament. They're coming at you thick and fast at the moment, team. That is it for now, though. We'll speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.